bold pledge. When Noah and his family came out of the ark, they acknowledged God by offering to him a sacrifice. And God pledged the rainbow as a sign that he would never again destroy mankind by a flood of waters. A rainbow was never seen before that time, for the reason given in the Bible, there had been no rain. Furthermore, the sun's rays did not directly strike the earth, but merely through the canopy, with much the same effect as that of a hothouse. Many changes were brought about by the removal of the canopy. Rain, flood, drought, thunderstorms, tornadoes, extremes of heat and cold. These things were impossible under the canopy. Noah's intoxication is accounted for along these lines. The juice of the grape had not previously fermented. Hence, Noah could not have known of its intoxicating effect. With the collapse of the watery envelope came the extreme heat of the tropics and the extreme cold of the polar regions before the ocean currents modified them. The change must have been almost instantaneous. We have proofs of this. In northern Siberia, an antelope was found embedded in ice. It had green grass in its stomach, which proved that its death occurred suddenly while it was feeding. Similarly, a mastodon was found embedded in ice with food between its teeth. Thus is demonstrated that the poles were once as equable as the temperate zone, and that in a moment came such a change as could be brought about only by the breaking of the canopy. The great glaciers and heavy ice of the Arctic regions, formed thus suddenly, have existed for centuries. The water did not all congeal into ice, but like a tidal wave, carried great glaciers and boulders across the North American continent and northwestern Europe, as scientists have clearly traced. They cut through hills with such force that they have left their mark for all time. Equatorial currents, the Gulf Stream and the Japan Stream, have since thawed out much of the polar ice. Demigods of Greece and Egypt, long have the learned wondered what foundation Grecian mythology might have had. Now, taking heed to the sure word of God, we perceive that the angels who materialized before the flood were the gods of mythology, while their offspring, the giants, were the demigods. The suggestion may well start a flood of reflection in thinking minds. Egyptologists have been astonished by their findings in the tombs of the pharaohs. In some of these, historic tablets have been found tracing the ancestry of the pharaohs apparently back to creation, the first pharaoh, Adam. But these tablets show so many more generations than the Bible records that Egyptologists lose all faith in the Genesis account. They become higher critics, discount the Bible records, and pin their faith to the Egyptian tablets. They confess, however, that these tablets vary and more or less contradict each other. Conceitedly, the most accurate is the Abydos tablet, found in the sepulcher of Sepi I, probably the pharaoh who made Joseph his prime minister and who is supposed to have died about 120 years before Moses was born. The chief fault found with this tablet is that it is not so lengthy as some of the others. Nevertheless, Pharaoh Sepi I preserved this tablet for us with great care. He sank a shaft 60 feet deep through solid rock. At that level, his masons cut out the stone staircase on which the Abydos tablet is portrayed. An exact copy of it is to be found in the British Museum. At considerable expense and with difficulty, we have secured the photograph of it, which we here present. Our object is to show that this best of Egyptian records fully corroborates the Genesis account. This list of pharaohs is shorter than the others because it omits the names of gods and demigods. It is the complete Egyptian record of the purely human line of rulers back to Adam. Furthermore, these omissions occur at the appropriate place, at the time of the deluge. Adam, Mena, was pharaoh first. The Abydos tablet fully agrees with Genesis and is often corroborated by the Greek and Egyptian historians Herodotus and Manetho. It shows Adam as the first Pharaoh and Noah the 20th, while the intermediate 18 correspond with Genesis with remarkable accuracy. Mina's wife was Shesh, Hebrew Isha, woman. Her first son was Pharaoh second, Greek Peter Kent, guilty one, Hebrew Carnegie, Latin Athos, English Cain. The tablet for Abel represents him as the non-resistant one. The Abydos tablet shows the same order as Moses, giving first the line of Cain down to Jabel, who was taken. At that time, evidently, the gods and demigods began to fill the earth with violence. Sitai's list omits the names of these. All demigods were destroyed in the deluge. Noah is next in order with a regal title. But since he was not of Cain's family, the Abydos tablet there goes back, mentions Abel and Seth and Seth's line, just as given in Genesis, untitled, down to Noah. These all, as pharaohs, have their royal ovals, but no super titles. After Noah, Nofru, Pharaoh 20th, the line runs through his son Ham, Kemu Chufu. Appropriately, Noah's other sons are ignored, for Shem and Japheth went to Asia and Europe, while only Ham went to Egypt. Thus wonderfully is the Bible being vindicated by the very inscriptions once supposed to contradict it. Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. Besides this, he was Jehovah's prophet and so certified by Jesus. Although Moses lived 2,000 years after Adam, history connected up very close to his time. From Adam to Moses, there were the five intermediaries: Methuselah, Shem, Isaac, Levi, Amram, whose lives overlapped by periods ranging from 31 years to 243 years, as shown in our diagram. The Tower of Babel. Years after the deluge, the world began to be populous. The narrative handed down by Noah and his sons was more or less forgotten, and the Bow of Promise lost much of its significance. Losing confidence in God, the people began the construction of the Tower of Babel, which was to save them in spite of God from any flood of waters of the future. Alas, how short-sighted, like others who possess much worldly wisdom. The scriptures deprecate such lack of faith among Christians and attempt to protect themselves and their earthly interests, leaving God and his plan out of their calculations. Some today ignore God after this manner, saying, "Trust not in the Lord for the things promised. If you wait for God to do for you, nothing will ever be done." In other words, we are living in a day when faith in the divine will and in the divine plan and promises seems to be on the way. God settled the matter by confounding the language and scattering the people so that they could not cooperate in further foolish undertakings. The Bible refers to this saying, "He hath determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation, that they should seek the Lord, if haply they might feel after him and find him." The diversity of languages is one of the most remarkable things in the world, an effectual barrier to prevent mankind from combining for the accomplishment of their own purposes, selfish or sinful. It has delayed the great day of wrath. Now the language barriers are breaking down, and we find the tendency of humanity to reunite. Unions and trusts are being built by the rich and the poor, each for self-protection. The rule of kings and princes is threatened by the growth of common language and intelligence in the masses. Had these barriers been removed 2,000 years ago, similar results would have come too soon, according to the divine purpose, which is shaping earth's affairs in preparation for Messiah's kingdom, which will bless the entire human family. Abraham, God's friend. Abraham became the friend of God by his manifestation of faith, when in response to God's invitation, he left his own country and wandered in Canaan. By his obedience he became heir of the promise. In thee and in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. St. Paul explains that Abraham's wife represented this covenant or promise. Sarah's barrenness corresponded to the long-deferred coming of Christ in fulfillment of the promise. Isaac typified Messiah, the heir of the promise. Isaac's bride, Rebecca, typified the elect church, the bride of Christ, and his joint heir in the promise. St. Paul says that Hagar typified the law covenant made with Israel at Mount Sinai, and that the nation of Israel was typified in Ishmael. As Hagar and Ishmael were cast off when Isaac was born and had almost perished, so the Jewish people have been cast off from divine favor for 18 centuries, and today are nearly famished. As the angel of God pointed to the fountain of water and Ishmael was revived, so God's message now is pointing the Jews to a spring of water. Their Zionistic hopes are reviving. The sacrifice of Isaac typified the sacrifice of Christ, necessary in order for him to become the spiritual seed of Abraham with power to bless the world. The servant sent to call Rebecca, the bride of Isaac, is beautifully explained to represent the work of the Holy Spirit in calling the church to become the bride of Christ and his associate in the great work of blessing Israel and all the families of the earth. Rebecca's return with Eliezer represents the church's journey during this gospel age to meet Christ, the bridegroom who will receive her at his second advent. Abraham typified Jehovah God, through whose promise the blessing of all the families of earth will come. This promise has been the hope of Israel for 35 centuries. The destruction of Sodom. The Sodomites possessed a very rich valley and comparatively avoided that feature of the curse, declaring that bread must be won by sweat of faith. These conditions were conducive to the selfishness and sin which the Bible charges. Pride, fullness of bread, and abundance of idleness. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and needy. And they committed abomination. Therefore I took them away as I saw good. God saw good to make the destruction of the Sodomites an example of the fate of sinners. Death, not everlasting torture, St. Jude says. Jesus declares, fire came down from God out of heaven and destroyed them all. But the Bible teaches that the Sodomites are not hopelessly destroyed, that God's mercy through Christ includes the Sodomites, sinners though they were. Jesus himself, as well as the prophet Ezekiel, declares that at his second coming in his messianic kingdom, he will give a trial or judgment to the world in general, to all who do not have an opportunity in the present life. The Sodomites will then have opportunity to hear of God's grace, to accept and rejoice in it. Jesus declared that in that glorious epoch, the condition of the Sodomites will be more tolerable than that of the people to whom he preached at his first advent. The reason for this he explained, saying that if the Sodomites had been granted the same opportunity afforded the people of Chorazin, Bethsaida, and Capernaum, they would have repented in sackcloth and ashes. Wherefore, in the future testing time, it will be more tolerable for them than for people who heard and rejected the message. Ezekiel's prophecy is most explicit. It declares restitution and blessing for Israel, and incidentally mentions that the Sodomites will receive favor from God at the same time, under the new covenant, under Messiah's kingdom. There is a wideness in God's mercy, like the wideness of the sea.